Lake Mead's water feeds countless people in the Southwest, about 20 million, and countless farm acres in California. But two decades of drought combined with climate change have dropped the lake level so low, these are levels that haven't been seen since the 1930s when it was first being filled. In August, the federal government is expected to declare an official Lake Mead water shortage. We have plans for that, of course, but what are those plans and what do they mean for businesses and homes and people in Southern Nevada? We're talking about that with several people, and first up is Colby Pellegrino. She's Deputy General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. The Water Authority turns 30 years old this year. It's a wholesale water supplier providing Southern Nevada with water treatment and delivery. Colby Pellegrino, welcome to State of Nevada.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you here, Colby. First off, the federal government is expected to officially declare a shortage sometime this year, maybe in August, based on water level projections. How do they make those projections, and are they usually accurate?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The Bureau publishes every month what they call a 24-month study. So it takes a look at a projection of future reservoir elevations for the next 2 years going forward. They take data every month from water users about how much water they will divert, as well as hydrologic projections from the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center for projections of inflow. And every year, the determination, as you said, is made based upon taking that August 24-month study projection and looking at what the January 1st elevation in Lake Mead is projected to be. And that lake elevation projection is what's used to declare a shortage. There's obviously error in any model. There's that old saying that all models are wrong, some are useful. I think the 24-month study model is a very useful one. Mm-hmm. And obviously we miss, particularly when there's hydrology anomalies, when there's a huge monsoon that's uncharacteristic or a really late season snowstorm. But generally speaking, the model does perform with a good deal of accuracy, particularly when we look at Lake Mead going downstream.
And I wonder if you could give listeners maybe a numeric or visual idea of what we're talking about here. At what level is the lake now, and at what level does this shortage declaration take place?
That's a great question. So actually, as we sit today, Lake Mead is around elevation 1070. It's the lowest Lake Mead, actually, I believe. Yesterday, we hit the lowest elevation Lake Mead has been at since 1937, when the reservoir was filling. So a historically low elevation from Lake Mead. And again, that first trigger of shortage is elevation 1075. So we are below that elevation as we sit today.
Wow.
And we anticipate that based on all the data we have in the model, when the end of the year projection comes out, we see that end of the year projection in the model today, and it's in the high 1060s. And we have a fair amount of certainty that not a lot's going to change between now and that August study. And that August study is going to project that the January 1 elevation will still be below elevation 1075. And that will result in a shortage declaration for operations in calendar year 2022.
And when the shortage is announced, let's get to the heart of this. How will it impact Southern Nevada? What's going to change?
That's a great question. So what happens to Nevada is our allocation of water is reduced. And that means we are given 300,000 acre feet of water to use from the Colorado River each year. And in that first elevation of shortage, we have to take a 13,000 acre foot reduction to our allocation. So essentially, we'll have 287,000 acre feet to use instead of 300,000. And in addition, we have to do some other actions to help protect Lake Mead's elevation from a drought contingency plan that was signed a couple of years ago that add another 8,000 acre feet. So essentially, we have 21,000 acre feet that we need to help contribute to Lake Mead. So that reduces our allocation from that 300,000 acre feet down to about 279,000 acre feet. The good news for Southern Nevada is last year we used 255,000 acre feet of our 300,000 acre foot allocation. So I think the condition of the reservoir is underscoring the need for everyone on the river to conserve, including our residents. But we're not using our full allocation today. So there's not some massive cutback that needs to occur in order to stay within what we're going to be allotted under a shortage.
And I want to get to other water users in a bit. You know, on this program, representatives of your water authority have told us, and this has been reported as well, that we're going to be fine for at least the next 50 years. This year, it seems, I don't know, it feels a little bit more dire, but is that 50-year projection still viable or is that changing? Do you see it changing?
So we take a water resource plan to our board of directors every year that makes a 50-year projection. That 50-year projection assumes varying levels of shortage, climate change, drought, and different levels of demand growth here. The one thing I would say about the success of our water resource plan is every single scenario assumes that we achieve additional water conservation. And our water conservation has become a little bit stagnant in recent years. We haven't seen the gains that we've seen in the early years of the program. So yes, the 50-year plan is completely viable. The reality is everyone in Southern Nevada needs to do more to conserve water.
And the SNWA's conservation plan says it wants to get water consumption down to about 105 gallons per person per day by 2035, which is 14 years from now. From what I've read, 105 gallons per capita is about the average in the U.S. What's our current water consumption rate?
So our current water consumption rate is about 112 gallons per capita per day. We do look at 105 as a goal, but we also analyze getting down to 98 gallons per capita per day by 2035. And there's some big trade-offs in the amount of conservation we're able to achieve and the timing that we need to bring on those future resources. So I would say 105 is our easier reach goal, but if we really want to have that stretch goal and talk about where we need to be, that 98 number is really what we're aiming for.
You have a pretty famous program here to conserve water. It's the turf removal program. It pays right now $3 for every square foot of lawn that's removed, provided that lawn is replaced with desert landscaping. I wonder, with all the discussion of banning ornamental grass during the legislative session this year, if you've gotten more interest in that program.
We have seen an uptick in our applications, which we generally do. Believe it or not, a lot of people still don't know the program exists or they forget that the program's there. So anytime that program makes the media, either through paid advertising, but in particular, all the attention around AB 356, we see a bump in applications. And we've seen that, quite frankly, with the adoption of AB 356, we're going to be going gangbusters. We've eliminated through that incentive program today about the same quantity of turf, and it's taken us 20 years. And now we're saying we're going to double that amount in the next five by just getting rid of that non-functional turf that people aren't using. So we anticipate, as we start our community messaging, letting them know where those properties are affected and which ones are meaningful to you, that you're the property owner that has the turf that's subject to this legislation, that we're really going to start seeing a ton of activity related to turf conversions.
Now, I want to get to a little bit more on that in just a little while. But first, I want to turn to Luke Runyon. He is the Colorado River reporter for KUNC in Northern Colorado. You might have heard him on this station. We run his reports all of the time. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here live at the studio now that COVID is sort of on the wane here a bit. When Colby Pellegrino, I was wondering if other states are doing as much as Nevada to conserve water. And I'm talking about northern and southern states. You cover the entire Colorado River Basin. So are we at the top rung of conservation? Are other states pushing for it? What's going on?
I think Nevada and the Las Vegas Valley, I think maybe has to be very aggressive in its conservation.
Doesn't everybody though now?
Not necessarily. Kind of what Colby was just talking about, you know, the allocation to Nevada is small comparatively to the other states in the Colorado River Basin. And so Nevada in particular has to be very wise with its water use because its allocation is so small in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, a lot of this goes back to the 1922 Colorado River Compact, which is kind of the foundational legal agreement among all of the U.S. states that rely on the river. And, you know, states are still holding on to that agreement, particularly in the upper basin. So not as much in the lower basin, but in the upper basin states of Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming, there's still a strong push to develop new water supplies. The emphasis, I would say, is somewhat on conservation, but you hear a lot more about kind of these flagship projects like the Lake Powell pipeline, you know, there's
to St. George.
Yes, there's diversion projects to Colorado's Front Range. There's reservoir enlargement projects in Wyoming and in Colorado. So
is it basically we want ours and to heck with those in the South?
I think if you would ask those state leaders in the upper basin states, they would say, you know, this is about a rebalancing of how water is allocated in the Colorado River Basin. It's not our fault that we developed slower than the lower basin states. And, you know, we have this legal agreement that says that we have this certain amount of water that we're entitled to. And this is something that you hear a lot in the Colorado River Basin is there is a certain amount of water on paper that states say that they have the rights to. And you hear from leaders that say, we need to be managing this watershed as a whole. We need to be thinking of this very holistically. We need mm-hmm. to be managing this resource as a whole. But then we'll, the next sentence say, but we also want to protect our right to the river. We want to develop into our allocation. And so there's sort of this cognitive dissonance with some state leaders when it comes to management of the Colorado River.
And now back to you, Colby Pellegrino of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. I know these Colorado River Authority sort of negotiations are very touchy. Pat Mulroy worked on these for decades and was also always very careful about how she talked about it. But I wonder if Southern Nevada gets that same sense. Like, of course, we have to conserve here, just like Luke Runyon just said. But does it feel like the other states really aren't considering their water use and its impact on Nevada, on Mexico, on Arizona, and Southern California as much as we'd like them to?
I would say that, you know, peer-to-peer, the people that we work with in the other states are really eyes wide open to the challenges that the Colorado River is facing. If we want to do simple math, and million acre feet is a hard thing to understand, there's 16 and a half million acre feet of water allocated on the Colorado River. That means the amount people are able to use, plus another million acre feet or so in evaporation that's not accounted for in those numbers. So 17 and a half million acre feet of use if everyone takes what they have. The long-term average flow of the river since 1906 is shy of 15 million. So you've already got 2.5 million that can't be developed. And then climate, you know, this current drought is 12.4 million acre feet. So, you know, you look at that delta, 12.4 to 17.5, there's another 5 million or so that can't be developed. And then the climate change projections show that on the low end, we could be looking at 10 or 11 million acre feet long term. So there is a reckoning that has to occur between the amount of water that's used on the Colorado River. And we've seen those actions taken. We've seen the upper basin and lower basin do the drought contingency plan. We have the interim guidelines, which are up for renegotiation pretty much starting now. And I think that all of that is on the forefront of folks' minds. I think what differs state to state is how scarcity will be dealt with. And each state really has kind of its own water rights system and priority system that governs how those reductions take place. But I think generally speaking, everyone understands that there's an issue. It's really simple math. We mm-hmm. have to be able to do more with less long term. And I agree with Luke. I don't think everyone is doing the same amount, but I think it's incumbent upon everyone on the Colorado River to figure out how to do more with less.
And Colby Pellegrino, I wonder if I'm right in assuming this. In a way, I wonder if Nevada is sort of in the catbird seat here, because we just finished a couple of years ago the third straw into the lake. It's sort of at the bottom of the lake. It's about 860 feet. The level now is about 300 feet higher. It's at a level that when the water can no longer pass through the dam, we still have access to the water. Southern California is out of luck, but we'll still be getting water. The water will still be going into the Colorado River. And when it gets to that point where it can go through the dam and turn the turbines, fine, they'll get their water. But we have this drainage pipe at the bottom of the lake. Like, does that pretty much set us for the future?
I would say that what that did was secure our community's ability to deliver water. That's why we had such broad support for the $1.4 billion in investment that it took to get us there, was because that ability to access water as the lake goes down is critical. The other side of that coin is Nevada has 1.8% of the water allocated on the river. 1.8%. So Nevada cannot change the course of the river by itself. We are one of the most aggressive cities, I would say, not only in the United States, but in the world, on water conservation. And we can continue to be that way. And we have to lead by example with such a small allocation of Colorado River water. But the other states have to do their share. We cannot change the trajectory of the river by ourselves.
The drought in southern Nevada is 22 years old. In Lake Mead, you've seen the photos of the bathtub ring. It's way down, and the federal government is prepared to officially declare a water shortage in August due to the low lake level. Measures are being taken. Beginning in 2027, no planting of ornamental grass in Nevada, and existing ornamental turf will have to be removed. Southern Nevadas keep conserving and turning lawns into desert landscapes, but will that be enough to keep the water flowing to our taps and showers and to the thousands of other uses we have for it? We've been talking to Colby Pellegrino of the Southern Nevada Water Authority and Luke Runyon of KUNC. He's a reporter there who covers exclusively the Colorado River and all the issues surrounding it. And now I want to introduce UNLV Professor Kristen Averett. Her expertise is in climate resilience and sustainability. Professor Averett, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Professor Averett, you, by the way, are one of the scientists who shared in a Nobel Prize with Al Gore in 2007, and that was for his work on and your work on global climate change. I want your honest assessment right now of the drought and our water needs. I mean, from your perspective, somebody who's been looking at climate change for more than a decade, how bad is it?
Well, I think one thing that we can certainly say is that changes in our water resources, we've always expected that these would be where we would see the major impacts of climate change, both globally across the Southwest and certainly for the Colorado River. So none of what we're seeing necessarily right now is at all surprising. We expect it because it's consistent with the impacts of climate change, but also we've been anticipating the onset of this drought and these very direct impacts in our communities for quite a while now.
You know, we are in a mega drought, scientists say. Really briefly, what's the difference between a mega drought and like an old-fashioned garden variety drought?
Well, I think regardless of the semantics that we can use to define what the situation that we're in right now with respect to drought, what we can say is that with climate change, particularly with the intense heat, not just declines in precipitation, but the intense heat, that is actually taking what would have been a moderate drought and making it a severe drought. So we're essentially loading the dice in the system, and everything is just a little bit worse than it might have been otherwise. That's really how climate change is working. It's really exacerbating these extreme events.
And with your expertise in climate change, I doubt you think enough is being done fast enough, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think about what more needs to be done?
Well, I think on the adaptation side, that is how we're going to deal with the impacts of climate change. When it comes to water, we need to be seeing more, and I think we already are, particularly in Nevada and across the Colorado River Basin, collaboration to really manage the resource and really prepare for what might be coming in the future. As I said, you know, this is something that we've expected for a long time. And even if this particular drought doesn't persist and it ends in the next couple of years, make no mistake, it will happen and it will happen again. And so we need to make sure that we're essentially prepared for it. And then with respect to climate mitigation, we need to be doing all that we can to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We are at the state level committed to achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions reductions by the year 2050. And by doing that, that's really going to position us very well to try and ameliorate the longer term impacts of climate change that could really essentially hit the next generation, that is really our grandchildren.
Yeah, and I want to go back real quickly to Colby Pellegrino, Deputy General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Colby, 20 years ago, people here shook their heads when there was talk of desalination plants on the Pacific Coast. And essentially, these would be plants that Nevada would pay for, and then the water that California would get from those plants, well, we would take that water from their allotment, from California's allotment. Is the technology right now of desal plants good enough to make that viable, both in terms of supply and economics?
You know, desalination is an interesting thing. The California Coastal Commission has proven very difficult for those plants getting permitted, but there are several desalination plants in California today that are operating. What we're currently pursuing is close to that, but not exactly that. We have entered into a partnership with the Metropolitan Water District looking at doing a reuse project where Metropolitan takes some of the water that is being discharged to the Pacific Ocean, treats it to a much higher quality, and then moves it to a different location within their distribution system to recharge and reuse, and then has that same sort of Colorado River Exchange framework where we could pay for an investment in them developing this new water supply related to reuse and have an exchange of Colorado River water. They're in the early planning stages of that project, and we've agreed to cost share on the implementation of the design and environmental compliance associated with that. And right now, that's a little bit less expensive option than desalination is. And it's a project that our partners are looking to pursue that we think we have an ability to partner on a large project like that. So I would say, yes, desalination is still viable, but there's other options out there like this reuse project. And we're certainly keeping an eye on all of those things.
Do you have an idea, Colby, of maybe a cost estimate? Initial cost estimate for Southern Nevada Water Authority?
So our through our major capital plan, we presented this project, and our recommendation and approved capital plan by our board has $750 million in capital to participate in this project or a project like this over the next 10 to 20 years.
Now, I bring that up because another part of conservation is when we save water, it's great. We feel good about it. It saves, you know, tens of thousands of jobs in Southern Nevada. It really, really saves this state, but also Arizona, a lot of LA, California. But it also means SNWA takes in less revenue. So if it has these big projects coming up and this $750 million capital outlay, which was approved, if it wants to pay for more staff, water watchers for those big projects, isn't it inevitable we're going to see water rate hikes?
Well, I think that is inevitable, that water rates are going to increase. I think that's true of any place where you have capital infrastructure that has to be maintained. And it is a little bit of a perverse set of outcomes that we deal with, where mm-hmm. we are actually telling people that we don't want them to use the product that we're providing. The reality is those trade-offs in water conservation versus these other water supply opportunities, water conservation still makes the most sense from a cost perspective, from a reliability perspective. Water conservation is still the number one thing we should be pursuing.
We are talking about the Colorado River. In August, the feds are expected to make a declaration of a water shortage at Lake Mead. It's going to affect a lot of people, maybe not as much in southern Nevada as you might think, based on what we've just heard from Colby Pellegrino, Deputy General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. But right now, I want to bring in Kyle Roerink. He is a former reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, which a lot of people here know. And now he is executive director of the Great Basin Water Network. He was part of a years-long effort to defeat plans by the Southern Nevada Water Authority to build 250 miles of pipeline to take groundwater from areas throughout the Great Basin north of Las Vegas. Kyle, welcome back.
Howdy, Joe.
Kyle, I mean, I'm just kind of watch your thoughts. You know, the state legislature just approved and the governor signed a bill that will eliminate ornamental grass, and it has to be removed or start to be removed in 2027. And you fought the effort to build that pipeline. What more do you think has to be done as somebody who watches the water issue so closely here to keep Southern Nevada viable economically and just for people to live?
Well, I think what Colby has been saying is spot on. Conservation is our first, second, and third best options, and that's a line that I'm taking from her and her boss, Mr. Ensminger, but it's so true. So I think the path that the Water Authority has charted right now as it relates to conservation at Lake Mead is the path to be on. And I also think what Ms. Pellegrino said about wastewater treatment is also the way of the future. And I think California is obviously getting really serious about it. The new head of MET has a background in wastewater, and I think that's one of the reasons why he was chosen. So I think we have to continue on this path. And while we're dealing with this non-functional turf issue, the grass that's only used when somebody's cutting it, I think there will be down the road opportunities where we have to maybe look at the other green grass that remains in the valley as you know, a place to look at to get more water in the long run. And
yeah, well, what are you talking about specifically? What green grass?
I mean, I would say, you know, the front yards and backyards that still remain in HOAs or homes. And I think, again, it becomes a matter of education. And many of us have seen the Ryan Reeves ads and they're great. But I guess it will ultimately become a question of how does the public at large respond to those? And do we as a community and as a state have to kind of go in and rather than use carrots, mm-hmm. we have to use sticks.
Yeah, well, I want to turn that to Colby Pellegrino, Deputy General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. As Kyle Roerink said, we in Southern Nevada, maybe this is statewide, we use the carrot a lot. We don't use the stick. But so people are not required to remove their lawns. They get $3 per square foot if they do remove their lawns and replace them with desert landscaping. But you talked earlier about, you know, we sort of stagnated. Do you think there will come the point when you ask some young lawmaker, maybe a wizened lawmaker, to force this issue that people have to remove their front lawns and replace it with desert landscaping because we live in a desert? This isn't the Midwest.
I don't foresee us having to do that for at least the near term. We do have an incentive program that's still in place, like you said, the $3 per square foot. What really at the individual resident level matters just as significant as removing that turf is changing your watering clock. And we still see really poor adoption of our watering schedule, which is why we're putting more effort into water waste enforcement. We have a seasonal watering schedule. Right now it's 6 days a week, no watering on Sundays. But that schedule steps down in the fall to 3 days a week, and then in the winter to 1 day a week. And we see really poor compliance still with that seasonal watering schedule. And there's just about as much water savings value in following the seasonal watering schedule as there is in removing turf. So we're kind of attacking it from both angles. This first step with the legislature was targeted at the bulk, you know, the 3,900 acres out of the 5,000 that exist of non-functional turf that exclude what we think is non-functional in single family residences. But we do intend to really use that water waste enforcement, the tools we have from our advanced metering infrastructure, and pushing smart water controllers and things like that that get people to stop watering their grass mm-hmm. in the winter as much as they do in summer. When it's February and you know the daily highs are in the 40s, your water does not need grass 6 days a week, nor do your desert-friendly plants. They could get by with 1 day a week. Sometimes I shut my watering system off for all of January and February, and my plants do just fine. but really getting the community to adopt that seasonal watering schedule, particularly at the residential level, is something we're pushing really hard on.
I want to ask you one thing. 15 years ago, maybe it was longer than that, I think I remember there were about 20 water watchers. I called them water cops, hired by the SNWA. That level really was decreased during the recession. Where is it now, and where do you want it to be in terms of the number of people out there watching to make sure people aren't violating the water restrictions?
I don't have the FTE count off the top of my head, but I know we are north of a dozen right now, and that's just for the water district. Water waste enforcement is done by the purveyor members, not the wholesalers. And all of our members, Henderson and North Las Vegas, everyone has a water waste team right now that they are out deploying. And again, we're all sort of moving in the direction of that advanced metering technology where we can look at hourly reads and tell, okay, the only thing that uses that much water at your house is your lawn. And it's that signal's coming on every single day of the week in December. We're going to send you a letter. And we actually find that some of that outreach where we just send folks a letter is extremely effective because generally people want to do the right thing. And a lot of times people just forget. So we're doing all that we can to continue to remind the public, you don't need to water the same year round.
Okay. I'm here with Luke Runyon. He is a Colorado River reporter for KUNC in Northern Colorado. Kyle Roerink, executive director of the Great Basin Water Network. Colby Pellegrino, Deputy General Manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and Kristen Averett, a research professor at UNLV who specializes in climate change. And of course, we're talking about water, the Colorado River. There is going to be a declaration of a water shortage on that river, probably in August. What that's going to mean for Southern Nevada, we've talked about, and it sounds like initially it's not going to have a great effect here because of the conservation measures that are already taking place here. But there is a lot more happening out there. And Luke Runyon, I wanted to ask you something. Nevada isn't the only one dealing with water shortages and drought, and we have to do it here. You mentioned that earlier. But is anybody else who uses the Colorado River, I think it's seven states that rely on the Colorado, Lake Mead, all the other basins for their water supplies, are they doing as much, or is anybody doing as much, or doing something innovative to save water?
I think you're seeing more and more this discussion about new development in communities. And for a long time, there's been these, in each municipality, the land use people and the water supply people don't communicate. They're kind of in their own departments, and you have, the people approving developments, and then the water supply people have to go out and find the water supplies to actually make that possible. And I think you're seeing more and more trying to bridge that divide between land use planning and water. And I think that's something that you've actually seen here in Las Vegas. You had development rules that went in place back in the mid-2000s that, you know, stipulated where you could put turf on a property. And that's not something that you see in a lot of places in the basin. But I think you're going to see more and more because that outside water use is really where cities feel like they can be really aggressive if there's enough of an appetite. And I think that you're going to see more and more of that as water supplies get tighter, as rates go up, as new supplies just become harder and harder to find.
You know, in 2003, there was a state lawmaker, Dina Titus. She's now a congresswoman who proposed putting a ring around the valley because of growth here to restrict sprawl. I wonder, you've been doing it for 2 or 3 years now, covering the Colorado River, if there is any talk by anybody, I don't think it's happening here really, but I wonder if any other states are talking about restricting development to save water.
Not necessarily. And I think like this conversation that we've been having has been really focused on municipal water use, which don't get me wrong, that's very important. What different municipalities are doing to kind of rein in use, very important. But the basin, the majority water use is in agriculture. And really, that's where I think states are going to try and find the savings to meet other needs first. In the upper basin of the Colorado River, there are serious discussions about doing something called demand management. And essentially, this would set up a water market that would pay farmers and other water users to curtail their use in times like this when it's extremely dry and send that water to reservoirs in order to prop them up. That's something that's still in kind of the initial phases. And it's an intensely political discussion because when you start restricting someone's water, you're restricting potentially some of their livelihood, their ability to grow crops. And I think that, you know, that's an intense discussion that's taking place in the basin. But and even with the shortage in Lake Mead, the steepest cutbacks are going to fall on Arizona, and they're going to fall on farmers first, not necessarily in large cities like Phoenix and Tucson. So really, agriculture is kind of feeling the brunt of these shortages first.
I mean, I do feel for the farmers who have relied for decades on the river. But I also know from a layperson's perspective, if you go talk to people, they think, why are people farming in the desert anyways?
I mean, that this is the way that the West was developed. People moved out west and set up farms. They were encouraged by the federal government to set up homesteads, and the Bureau of Reclamation built these massive water projects to make it all possible. Even in the name, reclamation, it was about reclaiming desert lands for agriculture. So we've built up agricultural communities. We've built up cities that have a high demand for water, and shrinking that demand in order to match the shrinking supply that we're seeing is hard. I mean, you're talking about, hurting small towns that depend on agricultural economies. And that's not something that I think a lot of state leaders take lightly.
And I mentioned earlier Dina Titus. Kyle Rohrink, who is now with the Great Basin Water Network, used to work for Dina Titus. And Kyle, I want to bring you back in here. In the U.S. Senate today, they are talking about S-567, and it's called the Southern Nevada Economic Development and Conservation Act. It covers a lot of areas, but one of the big issues is 42,000 acres of public lands that could be sold to developers if it's passed. Kyle Rohrink, do you think this could impact water here, the Colorado River, and how?
Well, I think it's a question of, how many people are we going to usher in with this legislation over time? Is it 800,000? Is it more than 800,000? And as we usher in those new residents to the Mojave Desert and the not driest state in the nation, what does that mean for water demand? And you have to, looking at demand, you have to look at what's happening at Lake Mead and what are we predicting for 50, 60, 70 years out. When you do a lands bill of this fashion, you're implying that water will be there to serve residents and businesses essentially in perpetuity. So It's a question of what are we promising people? And we're moving forward with all of this as I think we're really starting to get a grip on the reality of the Colorado River. I think it's a very precarious situation, and I think we need to be extremely cautious about what we're inviting when we do these types of development tools. And I think we really need to consider the framework by which we are doing development in Southern Nevada. We're largely using a 20th century model. And, you know, I think it would be foolish for me to say, well, we can't do any development at all. You know, nobody would talk to me. They'd just think I'm a crazy person. And so, you know, that's not what I'm saying. I think what opponents of the bill are saying is, you know, what is the framework that we are using to develop the Mojave Desert?
If it passes, this bill would also require the completion of 6 erosion control weirs at Lake Mead. What are those? What do they do?
Yeah, I think, you know, weirs is that's the type of infrastructure that deals with diversions. But again, that's not a provision that is dealing, I think, with the greater water quantity issues. This isn't major infrastructure that we're talking about that is going to have a big impact on the future of serving 800,000 or a million people. Again, as it relates to language in the bill, you know, there's nothing in there that really addresses long-term supplies at Lake Mead and on the river.
Kyle Rorick, what is your suggestion? What would you like to see done now in terms of water? I mean, a big part of your job was defeating that pipeline. That's done. What else do you think needs to be done in Southern Nevada, in the Great Basin?
Well, I think, you know, looking like basin wide on the Colorado River specifically, I think there needs to be a moratorium on dam and diversion projects across the upper and lower basin. And, you know, I can say what I'm about to say, and I think others on the program, you know, right now, you know, really can't. But, you know, Southern Nevada is the best in the West right now as it relates to what's being done. Ms. Pellegrino is leading that effort, and she's doing so valiantly. But I think when you look at Utah, for example, you know, it's bonkers. It is absolutely crazy what they're trying to pursue, and they want to take water that doesn't exist. And so I think, you know, something that I am really committed to doing is working with stakeholders in Utah, in California, in Arizona, and making sure that we are not pressing forward with projects that just make absolutely no sense. And I think, you know, another thing that my organization cares a lot about is working with agricultural communities. I think we have to think about national food supply, international food supply. And a lot of people say, what the heck are people doing growing alfalfa in the desert? Well, that alfalfa goes to California. And, you know, if you eat your ice cream, you drink your glass of milk, like, there, you know, we're all connected here. This is all, there's a symbiotic relationship that we can't just deny there. So, you know, I think with a lot of it, just as it relates to water conservation, there's a big educational component about how we use water in the West, but also about, you know, what we value in the West. We value our spaces where we recreate and spaces for serenity, but I think we also value eating food as well. So yeah. it's very complex.
Luke Runyon, reporter for KUNC, you've covered Colorado River issues for years now, and I know you're not going to rip into any of your sources in any of the states, but you just heard Kyle Rorick talk about Utah's policies and things they're doing as, quote, bonkers. I know you're not going to say the same thing, but is anybody pressuring Utah, anybody at the federal level or other states within the river compact, are they pressuring them to, like, ease off of some of these ideas, like building a pipeline from the river to St. George? St. George is booming, so they want that. They want more growth. But is anybody telling them, stop it?
Yes. And in fact, there was a letter that was sent by the six other states in the basin to Utah just recently that said, we have serious concerns about your ability to build this pipeline and actually have the water to fill it. And, you know, we have legal concerns about your ability to build the Lake Powell pipeline. So this isn't just Kyle saying that the Lake Powell pipeline is, you know, maybe kind of a crazy project. Even some of the other states in the basin are doing, you know, something that we've seen a little bit more is like this public shaming of water projects that used to be forbidden in the Colorado River Basin. Now, I think, you know, rubber is meeting the road in terms of there not being enough supply to meet everyone's needs. And the other states in the basin that would be injured by the construction of a water pipeline are willing to speak up and say, we don't, you know, we have concerns about this.
You know, I don't know if this is part of Las Vegas's expertise in marketing, but the SNWA has really great marketing in terms of advertisements to conserve water. They use Ryan Reeves from the Vegas Golden Knights. He's essentially the brutalizer for the team. He'll go out there and punish another team's player who punishes one of ours. They're funny ads, basically threatening you, you know, not to waste water. Are other states doing anything like that?
In terms of using
advertising, marketing to conserve water.
Yeah.
Like in fun ways that people will grasp.
I think so. I don't have an example right off the top of my head, but yeah, I think like, again, if a city is wanting to grow and they don't have the water supplies to do it, they're looking for buckets of water that they can use, you know, and to free up. And I think that if you need to get creative and use some interesting, you know, branding and marketing language, yeah, you're seeing that throughout the basin that cities are doing interesting campaigns like that.
And Kristen Averett, I'm sorry, I'm just getting to you near the end of this program again, but you're an expert on climate change. What do you think the public messaging should be when it comes to climate change and these water issues?
Well, I think it's just so important that we understand water is part of climate change and it touches every single part of our life. I think we need to really be thinking very carefully, not just about the demand side issues, but also the supply side. And water touches our lives in very different ways. You know, we've been talking on the demand side, for example, very much about agriculture and municipal growth. But water is an important part of the picture for economic recovery, for economic development and diversification in our state as well. So it's an important angle that we need to be considering. And then similarly, when we're talking on the supply side, we've seen about a 20% decline in the natural flows in the Colorado River over the last 100 years or so. And about half of that is climate change. So we need to be thinking about what that future might look like as well and what diminished flows might mean on that supply side as we balance against the demand. Water just touches every part of our life, so does climate, and we really just need to think about this in an integrated and smart way. It's not easy, but I'm pretty confident that we can do it.
And I want to thank each of our guests for their time, their expertise. Kyle Roerink with the Great Basin Water Network, Colby Pellegrino with the Southern Nevada Water Authority, Professor Kristen Averett from UNLV, a climate change expert, and reporter Luke Runyon from KUNC in Colorado.